Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with Thomas Ricks. He is the Washington Post's senior Pentagon correspondent, where he's covered the U.S. military since 2000. Before that, he held the same beat at the Wall Street Journal, where he was a reporter for 17 years. He spent a lot of time looking over documentation, talking with people at high levels of the Pentagon about American involvement in Iraq. And he's produced a book that is getting a lot of attention. It's out now. I'm certain that you can find it in the bookstore. The title of his book is Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. It's published by the Penguin Press. And it concentrates most of its pages on the period of the occupation and decisions, sort of deliberate decisions that were taken by the U.S. military at a very high level. And he makes the argument that those decisions, in fact, did not make things better. They made things worse. That as the insurgency appeared and grew, that we did not pay attention to it, didn't recognize it for what it was. And in fact, he says, the leaders of the occupation took military decisions, commanded their troops in such a way that it actually encouraged the uprising. And now what I'd like to do is just read a few lines from the book to show you where he's coming from, and he certainly does not mince his words. Here's what he writes, the very first line of the very first page. President George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq in 2003 ultimately may come to be seen as one of the most profligate actions in the history of American foreign policy. The consequences of choice won't be clear for decades, but it's already abundantly apparent in mid-2006 that the U.S. government went to war in Iraq with scant solid international support and on the basis of incorrect information, and then occupied the country negligently. He goes on to write about the subtitle of the book. He says, the subtitle terms the U.S. effort in Iraq an adventure in the critical sense of adventurism, that is, with the view that the U.S.-led invasion was launched recklessly with a flawed plan for war and a worse approach to occupation. I'll stop there and get to our conversation here. Just a little bit more about our guest, Thomas Ricks. He was a member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams for national reporting. He has reported on U.S. military activities in Somalia, Haiti, Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He's also the author of the book Making the Corps and A Soldier's Duty. He's talking with us from Washington. He is at, I believe, at the Post, and we should say thanks to the folks at the Post for the high-quality connection here. Mr. Ricks, good morning.
Good morning to you, and thanks for having me. I thought that was a terrific summary of the book.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. The book, as I said, the bulk of the book has to do with the way the occupation was conducted. But certainly there is a section here that looks at how it is the decision was made to go to war in the first place. And I think certainly it is true that you find plenty of blame to go around, beginning all the way at the top with the White House, with the president, with the people who were advising him, and then on with the Pentagon and so forth. And maybe just to take a couple of moments to talk about the run-up to the war, everything before the victory. And you also do go on to make the point, as I think a lot of other people have, that there was never any question that we would win the initial war. No one doubted that the American military could beat the Iraqi army. The big question was what comes next. But if I asked you the question, direct responsibility, what it was, and started right with the president, if I asked the question, well, what responsibility does the president have here for this ultimately disastrous decision to go to war in the first place? How would you answer a question like that?
Well, I'd say he has a lot of responsibility because the buck stops with him in our system. I think the buck begins in some ways with Vice President Cheney and his speech before the Veterans of Foreign Wars on August 26, 2002, when he stood up and said, quote, there is no doubt, about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. And what we know now is that there were tons of doubts, but they've been suppressed inside the intelligence community, and the leaders of the intelligence community, most notably George Tenet, then the director of the CIA, was really not giving the president or the vice president the straight information, nor is there any indication that they really were pushing hard for the straight information about all the doubts analysts had. Once Vice President Cheney lit that fuse of going to war, I think the president also has to bear responsibility for the manner in which they went to war. Two key things happened there. They were extremely exclusionary in the way they went to war. What do I mean by that? Two types of specialists were kind of rejected as they offered advice. First, more known is the military specialist, people like Army General Eric Shinseki, who was the chief of staff at the time, who was arguing privately and ultimately publicly that more troops were needed. Now, whether or not you agreed with that, it should be paid attention to because he's a military professional who has spent decades studying issues of that sort. Similarly, there were studies done at the Army War College on the difficulties of occupation. There was a joint study at the National Defense University that brought in people from across the government, and they looked at the difficulties of occupation and warned quite explicitly about the need to do things like stop looting, to provide security on the streets. And that was not welcome. The second type of professional advice that was rejected was that of area specialists, people who spoke the Arabic language and knew its history and culture. And their warnings were also brushed aside. I think there was a reason for this, that it wasn't simply just incompetence. I think what all these people were saying to the Bush administration as it planned for war was this is going to be more difficult, more expensive, and more time-consuming than you guys think. And the Bush administration didn't want to hear that. What they did is they went to war, was systematically overstate the threat presented by Iraq and systematically understate the difficulty of occupying Iraq. So you wind up with a war plan, and this really should rest on the shoulders of Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and General Tommy Franks, the senior military commander involved in all this. They wrote a war plan that focused all the time and energy on the easy part, getting to Baghdad, and almost no serious thinking about the more difficult question, what do you do once you get there?
Mm-hmm. It seems that they had this feeling that once the initial military victory was achieved, that everything else they thought would just fall into place in an orderly manner, as if, we've all heard so often the image that somehow we thought that we would be greeted by the people of Iraq and they would throw flower petals in the path of the advancing American troops, would say, thank you very much for liberating us. That Saddam Hussein was a terrible guy, but he's gone now and we'll take it from here. As if we thought that then we didn't need to do anything else past that point. And one wonders why it is that the administration seemed to truly believe that that's the way things would go, why they were so unwilling to ask any negative questions or entertain any negative questions and merely felt that things, once Saddam Hussein was gone, things would literally take care of themselves.
It's an interesting psychological problem because, as you say, I think they really did believe that we would be greeted as liberators, just as they really did believe that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Basically, they drunk their own Kool-Aid. They talked themselves into this, and they excluded anybody who said different, which is a ferociously worrisome way to take a country to war. When you won't listen to honest dissent, when you won't listen to criticism, and you regard critics as disloyal. But they really did push people out of the room. A political example of this is Representative Ike Skelton, a conservative Missouri Democrat, very pro-defense, who sent a letter to President Bush in September 2002 laying out some of his concerns about an occupation, saying, have you really considered all the difficulties? Have you considered that this is a foreign land on the other side of the planet? We've never really occupied an Arab country before. And he raised a series of questions. The response he got from a White House aide was, Mr. Congressman, we don't need your vote. So you wind up taking a party to war rather than taking the country to war. And what they did with the military was also interesting. The military was raising a lot of questions. The uniformed guys were saying, is Iraq really part of the war on terror? Are we really going to be greeted as liberators? And the response they got was, you will consider, they were ordered, in a formal order, you will consider an invasion of Iraq part of the war on terror. And they were also discouraged from planning for Plan B. It's fine to have a plan based on rosy assumptions, but you also need a plan to say, what happens if our assumptions aren't borne out by events? And they really didn't have that in hand. It was almost as if the Bush administration didn't want to think, what if we're wrong?
I'd like to have you talk a little bit about the relationship between the Departments of Defense and State, because it seemed pretty clear early on in the administration who was going to have the louder voice. And you wonder why it was that someone with the stature of Colin Powell, someone who was as highly respected as he was and is, could be rolled over so strongly by Donald Rumsfeld and the Department of Defense, to the point that it almost seemed that people in the administration weren't particularly interested in what the Secretary of State might have to say about these things.
Well, it's funny. When you reach back to before 9/11, and it feels like reaching back decades rather than just 5 years, but before 9/11, in the first 9 months of the administration, Powell, I think, actually thought he had the upper hand. Powell came in very strong. It was Rumsfeld who was having constant fights with the generals at the Pentagon, and it looked like Powell was prevailing in policy discussions. Remember, the Bush administration came into office saying it would follow Clinton administration policy with Iraq, and all they wanted to do was use smarter sanctions. They were going to tighten up the sanctions, focus them more on preventing Iraq from getting weapons, and make them less punitive of the Iraqi people. And I think it really was not until after 9/11 that Rumsfeld began to get the upper hand, and Powell was kind of caught short. But it, more than anything else, I think, what Colin Powell is a good soldier. He really wants to be part of the team, and he remained part of the team even when they'd stopped listening to him and they were just kind of using him. But the real tragedy of Colin Powell is the speech he gave to the United Nations in February 2003, in which he laid out the case that the U.S. had against Saddam Hussein. And here was a man with enormous public credibility, I think probably more broadly credible with the American public than any of the other people, the senior people in the administration, President Bush, Vice President Cheney, or Secretary Rumsfeld. Powell delivered a speech in the U.N. in February 2003 that, unfortunately, we now know to have been almost entirely false. And some of the allegations he made that day were known to be fabrications, but nobody in the intelligence community told them. That's a real tragedy.
Also, one of the things we have to point to, and I think that you would point to, is a failure of congressional oversight. It is a failure by members of Congress also to ask tough questions of the administration about what its goals were and how it was going to go about trying to achieve those goals.
And I think that's another real tragedy. And in some ways, the worst of all, because it's a continuing tragedy. Here we are, 4 years into this war. The United States military now has been fighting in Iraq longer than it fought in Europe in World War II. Yet we have not had a single significant hearing on the conduct of the war. We have never had the division commanders, for example, called up before Congress to talk about what they did, how they did, and so on. That's a real departure from American tradition. During the Civil War, there was a committee on the conduct of the war so intrusive that it antagonized President Lincoln. During World War II, Harry Truman made his name as a senator by holding hearings on defense contracting. In other wars, you had hawks and doves. In this war, we have the silence of the lambs, a Congress that essentially is asleep. And that's bad for a couple of reasons. First, Congress is not just a forum for debate. It also is a means of collecting and producing and disseminating information. If we'd had congressional hearings, if we'd had accountability and oversight, the American people would understand this war better. And that's important in a democracy that is giving its sons and daughters and husbands and brothers and wives to the war effort. It also, I think, would have improved the war effort itself. One of the problems in this war has been the military has been slow to adjust and has really not wanted to look at the leadership failures of its generals. The U.S. Army is very good at looking at problems from lieutenant up to colonel. But the general officers as a class, for reasons that I really don't understand, are off limits to criticism. And that's where Congress could step in and start asking the tough questions that the military doesn't want to ask itself. Questions like, is Abu Ghraib really simply the story of a few abusive, very low-ranking reserve soldiers? Or were there decisions made by generals that helped create that situation. Or they could simply examine the gap between rhetoric and reality. If the training and advisory effort in Iraq is the key to our exit strategy, why is it under-resourced 4 years into the war? Why are so many of the trainers reservists rather than the water walkers, the generals of tomorrow? Why are you not putting your best and your brightest into this very important effort? But the Congress is not asking those questions, and so the American people really don't get a good view, good data on the war, and they're not helping the military do better. I think, obviously, Republicans don't want to embarrass their own president, but also Democrats haven't played this role either. I think Democrats are afraid of appearing weak on defense, and they've also kind of confused the troops with the generals. They want to support the troops, but they don't understand that one way to support the troops is to criticize the generals.
Just let me ask you about one more party here, the one that we belong to, and that's the media, and that despite all of the kind of criticism about the media's liberalness and media attacking the president and not seeing the good news in Iraq, all that kind of stuff, I think that you would make the argument and other people would make the argument that there was really a failure of the news media in this country to ask the difficult questions, and no one seemed to be asking them, and that the news media really didn't ask them either.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that entirely. I think during the run-up to the war, the media was flailing about a lot. It was confused, and it was having a hard time dealing with this torrent of assertions by the Bush administration that there was no doubt, or as Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said in September 2002, the debate is over. There is no debate, is what he said, about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. There's an assumption both inside the intelligence community, inside the military, and inside the media that when the President of the United States or the Vice President of the United States makes a flat-out assertion that there must be some evidence he has to support it. We now know that there really wasn't, that these guys had really talked themselves into it without any new evidence emerging, and they were not giving due regard to the skepticism, doubts, and contrary information. I think the media's record was mixed during the run-up to the war. I've gone back and read a lot of articles that were in the New York Times, the Washington Post, a lot of transcripts from TV shows. Some people stand out. Tim Russert on NBC's Meet the Press consistently asked good questions and kind of underscored that the administration really didn't have the certitude that it was pretending to have about weapons of mass destruction. What happened, though, is when the Congress is asleep, that kind of reporting doesn't resonate because you don't have a congressman stand up and say, wait a second, you know, Mr. Secretary, I see here that on Meet the Press, you really didn't have a good answer. The Congress didn't respond, didn't participate. And the Congress is really the engine of government and in many ways the engine of Washington. And when the Congress doesn't work, the rest of the system stops working. It's like trying to drive a car on three flat wheels with only half the cylinders working. And until the Congress wakes up, I think the American system won't be working very well.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Thomas Rix. He is the senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. He's covered the U.S. military for The Post since 2000, and before that, he had the same beat at The Wall Street Journal. He's been a reporter was reported there for 17 years. He was a member of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams for national reporting and has reported on U.S. military activities various places around the world, including Somalia, Korea, Bosnia, Kuwait, Afghanistan, Iraq. His new book is Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, published by the Penguin Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You are among the people that you're critical of in the book is Paul Bremer, who was appointed by the administration to be the civilian administrator of the occupation. And I think that you make the argument that he certainly made some important mistakes and that perhaps he was someone who simply was not equal to the task, was someone who had never had this level of responsibility, didn't have to manage an operation this big, and probably was not qualified for the job.
That's a good summary of what I have in the book, but I want to emphasize that it's not really a book of my opinion. It's a book based on reporting, of going out and talking to generals down to privates and reading tens of thousands of pages of internal documents. And those conclusions that you just laid out accurately were really the conclusions of other people who worked with Bremer and saw him. When he went out there, he made two key policy decisions that went a long way towards helping create the insurgency. He dissolved the Iraqi military and the national police, which created a large pool of angry, unemployed, armed men who had thought, because they've been leafleted for a long time by the U.S. military with leaflet drops of aircrafts, that the U.S. had promised to take care of them after the U.S. took over the country. Bremer also, at about the same time, issued a quote-unquote de-bathification order that said anybody who'd been a member of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party, a senior member, had no role in the future of Iraq, and that created a cadre of leaders, some of them quite evil people, some of them also people who knew how to run the electricity system or had leadership skills of a military type. And so he created this large pool of leaders and rank and file who were suddenly alienated from the American occupation. Then the U.S. military comes in and uses tactics such as cordon and sweep operations that also helped create the insurgency by scarfing up tens of thousands of Iraqis, some of them anti-American, some of them pro, many of them neutral, humiliated them in the course of arrest, stuffed them into Abu Ghraib and other detention facilities, held them cheek by jowl for months with hardcore al-Qaeda types. And when they came out of those prisons, they almost certainly were less pro-American than when they went in.
Well, I think here you also have been very critical, and again, this is not your personal opinion, but this is based on all of the kinds of interviews that you've done, talk with people, particularly in the military, about what it was they did and then what the results were. Have been critical of the decision that the military made to use the most aggressive tactics possible. As if they started out at the very beginning, if they saw any trace of resistance, any little bit of insurgency, what they said was, what we do from the very beginning is decisively, without question, with overwhelming force, crush that completely. And that that kind of decision went on simply to build, as you say, went on simply to build more and more bad feelings about the United States, ended up recruiting people into the insurgency. Whose decision was it to take that kind of almost indiscriminate, aggressive kind of approach to any kind of resistance, any kind of troublemaking from almost right from the beginning?
Really, it was U.S. Army culture. And a part of it goes to the great and really honorable rebuilding of the U.S. military that occurred after the Vietnam War. Those officers in the 1970s, 80s, and early 90s rebuilt the U.S. military after the really terrible problems that came out of the Vietnam War. And they created a wonderful military for fighting the Soviets on the plains of Central Europe. But it was a military that was unprepared for the task they found facing them in Iraq of putting down an insurgency. And a lot of the things that had become instinctual for the U.S. military, so as you say, like overwhelming force, really were the wrong answer. They were almost counterintuitive for the U.S. military. When you fight an insurgency, you don't use the maximum amount of force you can bring to bear. You use the minimum amount of force, kind of like a policeman. The minimum amount of force you can use to achieve what you need to get done. It's counterintuitive also in that the U.S. military tends to focus on finding and destroying the enemy. In a counterinsurgency, it's a much better approach to try to make the enemy irrelevant. The best way to stop the enemy from planting a roadside bomb is not to have high technology that detects it. It is to understand the people well enough so the people are willing to tell you when the bomb is being planted, and even better, to tell you who the bomb planters are. So what you wound up with was frontline soldiers who were doing a heroic job under terribly difficult circumstances, but simply had not been given the tools, either physically or mentally, to get the job done. One example, in the summer of 2003, the 1st Armored Division, which is a good unit, was in Baghdad and was told to stop looting in part of Baghdad. And some of the soldiers decided on their own that the way to do that was to make looters cry. They decided if you made somebody cry, that meant they wouldn't loot again. You won't find that in any counterinsurgency textbook or any manual that the Army puts out, but that's what they improvised. So they caught two teenage boys looting along with the boy's father, and they turned to the father and said, "Which of your sons do you want us to shoot?" And the father said, as most would, "No, please shoot me instead." They said, "You don't get that choice." And they took one of the boys around to the other side of a truck where he couldn't be seen. They took out a weapon, and they fired it past the boy's head. And then they let the three of them go. Now, they've perhaps achieved their short-term mission of deterring those people from looting, but they almost certainly have undercut the longer-term goal of winning the support of the Iraqi people, or at least the acquiescence of the Iraqi people, for the occupation. Overall, the U.S. military tended to see the Iraqi people as the playing field for this war, when really we should have seen them as the prize. That really was the thing you wanted to go after and bring over to your side. So when the generals started ordering large-scale cordon and sweep operations, scarfing up these tens of thousands of Iraqi males, it was exactly the wrong thing to do. They made their area quiet because they removed the men and they sent them off to detention facilities. But they also antagonized the population and helped turn it against the American presence.
Well, we have some callers I want to bring into the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good. Anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a lot of calls here. People, again, will help us by being brief in their comments. We'll start with Champaign County, Line 2. This is the first. Hello.
Hi. Wow. This is wonderful to be able to ask you a question. I'll try to keep it short and focused. As a younger person who has studied things, I think a lot of what has happened here is that there isn't as much of the generation of people who went through World War II and the Korean War and ended up with a real distrust of the military and the government, and that's kind of a traditional American value. If you look at the end of the Civil War and all the little conflicts, and I think that's what I find interesting about the Bush administration, is they seem to have almost the total acquiescence of the American populace, which, of course, you know, jeered Grant in the streets and things like that at times. So it's kind of an interesting change, and I'm just curious how you feel about American attitudes towards trusting leaders and if they've changed at all. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you give us some thoughts about that?
It's an interesting question. To a degree, I agree with the caller. To a degree, I disagree with him. I do think there is a tradition in American society being very skeptical of leadership. The oddity here is the U.S. military itself was very skeptical of the decision to invade Iraq. There were a lot of questioning inside the U.S. military. How is this part of the war on terror? Now, when they were ordered to do it, they saluted smartly and moved out, which is also our American system. I like having a system where the military, when it gets orders from the civilian leadership, executes them. I would not want the military saying, we don't think we like that order, we're not going to do it. There's a larger problem here I think the caller also is putting his finger on, and it takes me back to Congress, which is we don't have a Congress that has a lot of military experience. As late as the Vietnam War, two-thirds of the members of Congress were veterans. Today, two-thirds are not. And so you don't have that crusty old congressman who had been a sergeant in World War II or Korea looking at the generals in front of him and remembering, you know, these are the guys who sat and gave self-serving speeches for hours while I stood there carrying an M1 rifle at Fort Benning in the middle of the summer wearing a helmet and a pack and listening to these guys drone on when the only question I had in my mind is, when are they going to stop? I think in some ways the Congress shows too much deference to the military these days when it could really help the military by asking tough questions.
All right, let's talk with someone in Champaign County, another Champaign County caller, line one. Hello.
Hi. This is all quite complicated, and I've got a lot of notes, but I share your criticism of Bremer, but I think the other thing, and I think you might go into this, I've heard you speak a number of times, the economic kind of decisions that were made by Bremer, just sort of edicts, they numbered about 51, one of the few laws that he kept from the Bremer, from the Saddam era was the anti-union law. So this is not the kind of humiliation widespread that you referred to earlier, but it's certainly a kind of rule by diktat, which those kind of changes of the economic system are actually, by international law, are not allowed to go ahead under by an occupying army. So it seems to me that we need to look at that, and that sort of ties in with the fact that Cheney's energy plan included maps of Iraq. This is not from some investigation by a journalist, but it was Justice Watch, the right wing group that was dogging Clinton during the impeachment trial. I forget Judicial Watch, right? Who got Freedom of Information and found out between that and O'Neill saying that they were talking about Iraq at the first meeting he was at at the cabinet level. I don't think that your assertion that the Bush administration wanted to follow generally the Clinton plan, they were talking about quote-unquote smart sanctions because of all the pressure, because of the thousands of millions of children died, actually, I guess it's fair to say, in Iraq in the lead-up to the war.
You've made a lot of points.
Right, I have some more, but I don't know whether I'll get to them, but thank you.
Well, let me start responding to you. I just disagree with the interpretation advanced by Ron Susskind in his book on Paul O'Neill that the Bush administration came into office determined to invade Iraq. I think O'Neill misread what was in front of him. Yes, there were some hawks like Paul Wolfowitz and the office of the vice president who wanted to do more with Iraq, but I don't think the hawks thought they could ever get support for a U.S. invasion of Iraq. They were thinking more along the lines of supporting exile groups and maybe providing them with air power or logistical support. But that's simply a disagreement for the historians. I haven't seen this thing you're talking about with Cheney's Energy Task Force and an Iraq map. Your first point, I think, is a really good one, though, that the free market edicts that Paul Bremer laid down were also enormously counterproductive. They were doing things like shutting down inefficient government-owned factories. Well, the problem is you come in and you shut down a big government brick factory in Anbar province, and suddenly you have a lot of unemployed and rather angry people because they know who shut down the factory. And one of the things those people did was then some of them become employed by insurgents. Maybe they became runners carrying bombs into Baghdad. Maybe they started doing bomb construction. And this actually was raised internally to Bremer by the CPA, the occupation authority presence, by the guy out in Anbar province, a State Department official named Keith Mines. And I've read the email he sent to Bremer that said, you don't understand, what we need out here in Anbar province is a lot less Milton Friedman and a lot less Abraham Maslow. I mean, a lot less Milton Friedman and a lot more Abraham Maslow, meaning less free market economics along the lines of Milton Friedman and more attention to basic human needs along the lines of the psychologist Abraham Maslow. I want to point out also one of the fascinating things about reporting this book was the availability of information like that. People at the end of interviews would hand me a CD-ROM and say, here's a CD-ROM with every email I sent to Ambassador Bremer during my time out there. Another officer said to me, here's a CD with every PowerPoint briefing I received during my year in command there.
I hope the caller will forgive me. I have someone else here I want to get to. We're moving into about our last 15 minutes. I want to introduce again our guest, Thomas Ricks. He is the senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, also had that same beat for The Wall Street Journal, and is the author of the new book, Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Penguin Press. On to another caller. This is someone in the nearby community of Belgium on our line 4 right here. Hello.
Good morning, sir. Mm-hmm. I hope I can express the question and point that I have properly here. It seems that you've missed one person that's very important in this whole escapade that we have, and that's Karl Rove. He has this desire to turn the whole world at least all of the United States, into a right-wing Republican situation. And in his process, he made everybody a yes man for George Bush. And that really defeated what we wanted to do when it comes to this really tragic incident in our,
Well, can you comment on that, Mr. Rick?
Well, it's an assertion. I didn't hear a question there. All I can say is it struck me that in reporting out this book, I found very little evidence of Karl Rove's footsteps. He's kind of become a boogeyman for the American left. But in the prosecution of the war, he really didn't come up that much in conversations I had.
No, sir, but I realized that he didn't really have so much to do with the war, but he really influenced the politic, the body politic that was going on at the time, because he had such great influence with the Christian right and everything else, who was pushing very hard for this war. Yes, that's what I'm getting at. He had influence in the background that led up to the war at the time when we were involved with all the political machinations that he did during this period of time.
I certainly would have expected that he would have helped shape the White House approach to how it dealt with Congress and the speeches and so on. But again, I have to say, in thousands of pages of documents and hundreds of interviews, really his name didn't come up.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 in here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. All along for some time now, there have been people who have called for the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, to step down. And just recently now, there was some conversation about that in the Senate. The story, I believe, is that at a couple of points, he actually was prepared to submit his resignation to the president, and the president said he would not accept. Having said all that, do you think at this point, having Mr. Rumsfeld step down as Secretary of Defense would do anything?
If Rumsfeld left, I think a lot of people in the military would look for the message, okay, what does this mean? And the meaning would be determined, I think, largely by who they chose to replace him. If it were somebody who said, I want to chart a whole new course here, that I don't want to either cut and run or stay the course, the two very sterile alternatives that have characterized our debate about Iraq, I think that might send an invigorating message to the military. But if it were simply somebody who said, I'm just going to be a caretaker and continue this out, I don't think it would make much difference at all. It would be difficult to find somebody at this point. We're in the last couple of years of this administration. It takes time to collect the reins at the Pentagon and to start influencing events. And there's not, frankly, that much time left for a new Secretary of Defense to come in and do that. So increasingly, Iraq is becoming a problem not for President Bush, but for the next president.
I think that it is the case that within the Pentagon and within the White House, they've come to understand that American support for any kind of military activity is inversely proportional to the number of casualties. And so that there has been one of the important goals here of our war fighting in recent years, maybe ever since Vietnam, has been this deliberate effort to minimize casualties. Do you think, in fact, if that indeed is true, did that somehow contribute to the problems that we've talked about?
Yeah, I think the issue of force protection, which is the U.S. military term for keeping troops alive as much as possible, I think did kind of mess us up on the ground in Iraq. If you tell soldiers you can do anything you think you might need to do to protect yourself without regard to the consequences, you wind up killing innocent Iraqis. And it transfers the risk from the professional soldier to the Iraqi civilian. The rules of engagement, for example, in the 4th Infantry Division that soldiers told me about were anybody who was carrying a shovel at night along a road would be shot because the assumption was he was out to dig holes for IEDs, for roadside bombs. And that's being revisited right now by Lieutenant General Corelli, the number 2 U.S. commander in Iraq, who said, wait a second, fellas, we're here to protect Iraqis, not to attack them if we think there's a vague possibility that they might be threatening. So that's changing. But frankly, the U.S. casualties in Iraq, we've had now about 2,600 U.S. deaths, close to 2,700 now. That's not a lot for a U.S. war. I mean, it's a fraction of what you've had in major U.S. wars, and in fact, it's left fewer Americans than died on 9/11. I think, actually, what really drives U.S. public opinion, and this is according to some political analysis, especially some professors down at Duke University who did this, what really shapes the American view of a war is whether or not they think we can win it. And I think what you're seeing in the declining support in public polls for the war in Iraq is not a fear or dislike of casualties, though nobody likes them particularly. It's more in a sense that we're not winning this thing and that we're not seeing a credible outcome to this. This war has been going on for a long time. As I said earlier, we have now been fighting in Iraq longer than we fought in World War II in Europe. By the end of this year, we will have been fighting in Iraq longer than we fought in World War II in Pacific. So this thing has gone on a long time, and we're still fighting for control of Baghdad. So I think what you're seeing the American people asking is there any credible strategy for actually prevailing in any way in Iraq and achieving an outcome that we are more or less comfortable with?
Let's talk with someone here on the phone in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Got a question and a reading suggestion for Mr. Ricks. The question is, how much sustaining support has been given to the administration by right-wing institutions and media, such as, you know, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute for Institutions, and pop right-wing culture types like Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Ann Coulter. I'll wait for that and then tell you my reading suggestion is The Pirate Coast by Richard Zaks, showing our mucking about in the Islamic world goes back 201 years.
Mm-hmm. Interesting suggestion. Although I think we mucked about a bit 200 years ago, but we really didn't get involved with boots on the ground in this way until recently. I think the political culture of this country has helped this administration a lot. But I don't want to be partisan here. I worry about the left as well as the right, in which instantly in any policy debate, rather than debate the points of policy and try to parse through the issue, we simply leave to ad hominem attacks on people. And so rather than say, here's where I think your policy might be wrong, they simply attack the other side's motives, the other side's character. They assume that anybody who disagrees with them is a liar. I am appalled when I see demonstrators call for torturing or killing President Bush. I don't care whether or not you agree with him. That is not a good thing for this country.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions, comments? 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me just make one point I'd like to make about the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I've really been surprised by the reception it's had from the U.S. military, which has been very warm and supportive, including emails I've gotten from guys in Iraq who ordered it through Amazon.com and got it out there very quickly. They really tend to like the book. One battalion commander wrote to me, thank you for saying publicly what we've been saying privately. I've had a number of generals take me aside and say, it's good that somebody finally did this, that we need this book. This is helping us. And that's been a really gratifying thing for me. It's nice to have good book sales. It's nice to see it number one on the bestseller list. But I'll tell you, it really means much more to me that serious military personnel, that officers and sergeants alike have said this is a book that they really are thankful for.
Well, we have about 7-8 minutes left. I'll give the title once again, Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, published by the Penguin Press by our guest Thomas Ricks. He is a senior Pentagon correspondent for the Washington Post. There's been a little news item here that I want to ask you about. It's being reported that coalition forces have now handed over control of Iraq's armed forces command to the government of Iraq. That apparently just happened, and the United States says this is an important milestone in the move of Iraq toward independence. How significant an event is this?
Only time will tell. They constantly put out announcements about transferring control of an area from a U.S. military unit to an Iraqi unit. I'm becoming rather cynical about those because I think what they're doing is actually transferring lack of control of an area from American units to Iraqi units. That said, the Iraqi army, I was pretty impressed when I was out in Iraq on my fifth trip earlier this year in January and February. The training could be better, but it's good. The Iraqi army is coming together. The big question that I had and some officers doing the training had is, what are they being trained for? Are they being trained to support the government and provide security, or are they being trained to fight a civil war? And none of us can know the answer. The Iraqi police are another question altogether. A lot of worry inside the U.S. military about them, that a lot of these guys are really just death squads in uniform.
Mm-hmm. Well, that perhaps it gets at, again, one of the other questions that that I have had all along about this war, and that is something like, how is it that the United States could have so failed to understand the basic political dynamics of this country, and failed to understand that if the central authority was removed, if you took the lid off, then the natural tensions between the groups in society that are competing for power, the lid would be off. There would be nothing to control them anymore. And how quickly we've now seen how quickly we get to the point, whether you're willing to call it civil war or not, how quickly we get to the point where you have real bloody confrontations between people over the simple issue of who's going to run the country.
And what makes this so sad is this information was available. American experts were saying this. They were putting in reports inside the Army, at the National Defense University, at the State Department, at think tanks. They were putting these issues out there. And I think the media could have done a better job of reporting all those doubts and concerns. But more importantly, more especially, the Bush administration pushed those warnings aside, didn't want to know, neglected them. Reports were actually sent to the Pentagon offices and their, you know, overseeing policy, and there was no response, and they were thrown down the memory hole. So the answer is, why weren't these experts' views? And there was a real consensus that you summarized accurately about what the problems were. Why weren't those conveyed more to the American people? And again, I would go back to Congress. The media could have done better, but the Congress should have held exhaustive hearings that examined those issues. And if the Republicans wouldn't hold the hearings, there are things the Democrats could have just put out reports by themselves. But the Democrats, I think, saw this as a speeding train that they didn't want to stand in front of.
Let's talk with another caller here again in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, I enjoyed reading your book very much. It's excellent. I learned a lot from it. I want to ask you about a related country, Afghanistan. It seems that in recent months, the situation there is going downhill as far as the control of the country and the rise of the Taliban again. I was wondering if you had any comments on that. I'll hang up now.
All right.
It's odd that you should ask. I love Afghanistan. I lived there as a teenager, went to American International School of Kabul. I was a member of the Afghan Junior Ski Patrol, and I skied the Selang Pass and actually broke one of my skis up there skiing through an old avalanche. I worry a lot about Afghanistan. We're dropping a lot of bombs out there right now, and the south, the area around Kandahar and Uruzgan province looks very worrisome. And so I have a lot of worries about that, and I just hope we do better out there, and I'm very worried about also the NATO forces that are coming in from our allies. Canada, for example, is having a rough time down south, and I've been following their casualties in the Canadian media. They're not being really paid attention to in our country, but I'll tell you, the Canadian media is paying a whole lot of attention to them.
Just in the time that remains, we have about a minute or two left. Can you talk a little bit about what you think might happen in Iraq here now in the next couple of years?
What I would like to see happen is the example of Colonel H.R. McMaster up in the what he did in Tal Afar in northwest Iraq earlier this year. Took a really radically different approach, went around to all his troops, looked him in the eye and said, every time you disrespect an Iraqi, you're working for the enemy. Went to the insurgents and he apologized, which is a striking thing to do and a show of strength. And he said, the time for honorable resistance is over. But he has also kind of apologized for American behavior early on. I think on a national scale, that sort of approach might work. I don't think it's going to happen. I think what you're going to see for the next couple of years is the Americans still acting like a bunch of men at the bottom of a deep hole, thinking they can get out of the hole by just digging harder. So I think we're in for a long, hard slog. When I was writing this book, I'd look out the window sometimes at some kindergartners who would walk every day from the school near my house to a daycare center. And I would think one of those kids is going to fight and die in Iraq.
So you think that in a dozen years from now, we could still have troops in Iraq and they would still be fighting?
I think as long as American troops in Iraq are in Iraq, some will be fighting. And, yes, I think we'll have smaller numbers. I think we'll probably get down to maybe 30 or 40,000 by the end of next year. But I think then we'll have troops there for a long time. Remember, the U.S. had troops in the Philippines from 1899 to 1946.
Well, the book, if you want to read it, and there's a lot here, is Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. It's published by the Penguin Press. It is in the bookstores now. And our guest, Thomas Ricks, is the author. He's the Washington Post senior Pentagon correspondent, where he has covered the U.S. military since 2000. And Mr. Ricks, we want to say thank you very much for talking with us.